conservative part of the action. And then the card will take over and discuss the effect of the tail terms in the over the dynamics of the binary system. About the literature, this is a paper where we reproduce the 3PN dynamics, which is the tail term, and hopefully we'll get out the 4PN sometime next year. So, okay, we are computing the energy of a binary system at 4PN. There will be so no radiation going away, no spin. And the question is this useful for this LIGO or not? I don't think I can add much more to the discussion to what Alessandra and Michaela said yesterday. So to my understanding, there is no definite answer to this question. About Michele said yesterday that we will know whether these terms are useful once they will be computed, basically. So I don't add anything. I just say that possibly this term will be of some relevance for the phenomenology in the forthcoming years. So this is the first part. Let's start it. Again, I'm not going to introduce you the FT. I will just tell you that for our purpose, basically, what we are doing is integrate out or eliminate or solve for the degree of freedom we don't observe. Here in this case, we start from a notion which depends on the metric and of the two variables of the stars. And we integrate out the metric, or the gravitational interaction between the two stars. I remind you that there is no gravitational interaction, gravitational radiation going their way. So this is what all we do to need. Now, doing this integration in field theory means, if you can develop it perturbatively, it means just to calculate a set of a bunch of Feynman diagrams. And it is a very mechanical procedure, if you think about it. If you want to know the dynamic at a given PN order, you have to determine all the Feynman graphs which are relevant to that order and compute them using the Feynman rules. So it's really the kind of job you really think a computer can do efficiently, especially the Feynman diagram are many. So this is the plan of my part of the talk.
The big formula, you're missing a log, no?
I'm missing what?
A log. The log of the integral.
Or an exponential.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Okay, this algorithm is basically a plan of a talk. We had to determine all the Feynman diagrams at a given PN order. This is done in two steps. We use first determine the shape of a diagram, which is determined only by gives you the power of G. Then you determine which degrees of freedom, which polarization travel along this diagram, which gives you the power of V. Then you have the amplitude. And then you compute the amplitude in momentum space in dimensional regularization, and you get a piece of effective Lagrangian for the dynamics of the two stars. And you do it for all the Feynman diagrams. So let's start from the first point, which using the terminology of Gilmore and Ross, I call topology, the shape of the diagrams. To fix notations, these horizontal lines are not dynamical. They're just the external sources, the two stars. The dynamics is going on here, the gravitational degree of freedom being a change between the two stars. Okay, and how did we code in Mathematica this representation of the diagram? We have three propagators, so each propagator is a line in the matrix, okay? So this line is going from here to here. I identify a propagator from its starting point and its end point, so the two vertices where it starts and ends. So each vertex is described by the triplet of numbers. This is a vertex, this is actually this vertex. And the meaning of this number is first number gives you the position of a vertex. 2 means the vertex is here on particle 2. 1 means the vertex is here. And 3 means the vertex is in the bulk. The second number here is the number of legs which are attached to this vertex, the number of gravitational modes which interest this vertex. So in this case, which is this vertex, there is just one leg going up. And the other one is just a label, because you might have two vertices of the same kind, like this, and this will be number one, number two. Okay? This is just a way we code this information. Okay? And then there is a little code which exploit the graphical abilities to of mathematics to draw it for us humans to understand what you're doing. So there is a very simple rule to determine all the topologies. If you have a topology to a given, which, what is the power of G associated with topology? You have a square root of G to each vertex. So it is a G squared one. If from G squared you want to go to G cube, you basically attach a leg to this vertex, starting from a particle, either or in the middle of a propagator or in the vertex. You do it in all possible ways, and you obtain other vertices. Okay? It's a bit redundant because you normally obtain more times the same topology, but you can really easily implement a mathematical program which acts on this topology, then transforms it and generates other topologies like that, and then get rid out of the redundant ones. So you basically, to generate all the topologies, you up to 4PN, which is up to G to the 5, you start from the simple one, the Newtonian one, and you apply this rule. If we do it just, I will just discuss this part. You do it here, you can obtain two kinds of topologies at 1PN, in principle, G squared. But I anticipate you that if we do this matrix of variable introduced by Cole Smolkin, this topology turns out to be suppressed because all the diagrams associated to this topology are suppressed by powers of V squared. So this topology, which naively would enter at 1PN, actually enters in the game only at 2PN. This is very important because you can economize on Feynman graphs. Same game you play. Now you, from here, you generate all the topologies at G cube. The first five actually enter at the lowest possible order, which is 2PN. The other four are suppressed. They enter at 3PN. Same game, G to the 4. The 32 topologies, the first eight enter immediately. Other 21s enter only at 4PN. And there are three which are suppressed by a power of V to the 4, so we actually don't consider them. OK, so far we could have done it by hand, but then you come to G to the 5. There are 164 topologies. And a posteriori, actually find that only 50 of them are relevant at 4PN and are drawn here. The drawing problem does not do it very well. There are some line crossing here that make it sound more complicated than what it is. But OK, just to give you an idea.
So the enumeration never gets loops.
You don't get loops because you're doing classical theory.
No, I know. But the enumeration gets them when you cut them out, or you never get them?
No. It's built in a way that you don't get it. Mm-hmm. The rule by the telling you is avoids loops. OK, so we have all topologies. So far, I didn't even specify the theory. Is this valid for any theory, gravitational-like theory, which coupled to matter with G Newton in front of it? OK, the structure is universal. Now, actually, we want to specify the theory. We pick up GR. And we also choose the variables of Cole-Smolkin, which is gives it this parameterization of a metric. Okay, VCD is this number. I keep it dimensional generic because we had to do dimensional regularization. So next step is to draw graphs. For each topology, we have to put actual degrees of freedom traveling in it, actual polarizations. And this is done by just turning this matrix into a more rich one. Basically, to each line, which is each propagator, we add a number which tells you which polarization is propagating in that in that propagator. So in this one, number one means that the field phi is propagated here. And in the other two, the field sigma is propagated. And moreover, in the second number of each vertex, which was telling you how many legs are associated to which vertex, you had to tell how many legs of each kind are associated here. So for example, this vertex here have one leg of the phi kind and zero leg of the other two kinds. And this vertex here has one leg of a phi kind and two legs of sigma polarization. OK? Now, how do we determine the V square contribution associated to this graph? We just write the your action, fundamental action, in terms of these variables. And this is a truncation of this action to tap just to the term which are needed at 4PN. We do the same for the point particle action, and we just count. For example, here, this vertex is here, and you see that if you expand it at, for more small v, the lowest order doesn't get any correction. But actually here, you had you have two powers of V associated, which is sigma. So you get a V square here and a V square here, V to the fourth. This is not over because this sigma, sigma phi vertex, you can read it here. You can U with a phi here, OK? You see there are two derivatives acting on sigma. And since there are not outgoing gravitons here, there is no radiation, in the end, you can turn the derivatives by part and make them end on some particles, either the one or the two. So these two time derivatives will end up acting on the part of the stars. That makes another power of V squared. So this diagram is G squared V to the sixth. It is a 4PN diagram. Okay? So basically, you play this game. For this topology, you fill it with every possible polarization, and you count the powers of V. And if the order of the diagram is 4PN or less, you keep it. Otherwise, you throw it away. We do this, and you will obtain over the Feynman diagram of the theory. Up to 2PN, they have been drawn for the first time by Gilmour and Ross. They use a slightly different notation, but basically, they are their diagrams. These are the contribution of 3PN. We have so 17 diagrams here, 63 diagrams here, that will make a total of 80. And these are all the diagrams we needed to evaluate in order to reproduce the 3PN effective Lagrangian, exactly as it is written in the linear beam of Branchet. That's the work we did in this spring with Ricardo. Now, we go to 4PN, and we have these diagrams. We're really happy you have a computer doing that. But actually, if you look at them, their shape, you will see that it's not very different from the shape of some of these diagrams, meaning that the strategy of integration or evaluation of the diagram will be pretty much the same. It will be slightly different, but our code, our 3PN code, which could do all these diagrams, can basically do all the diagrams up to here. But there are some more. Now the topology becomes more and more complicated, so we have to, for each new topology, you would basically the code will stop and will tell just, I don't know how to do that, and we will just look at this, give him a recipe to evaluate it, and then going on. Okay, that makes a total of 595 to evaluate. This is not over because, as you know, there is a tail term, the effect of a tail term on the conservative dynamics, but this is a matter for Ricardo. We will discuss it in the second part of the talk. I will just discuss how to evaluate all these 600 diagrams. So we have all the diagrams. Let's compute the amplitude. We need to have a Feynman rules, we deduce them from the Lagrangian. So we have a propagator. First of all, a thing I forgot to say before, that in this variable, the propagator is diagonal. So if you have a phi starting here, you are sure you don't have another field arriving there. If you use,
out of the 600 diagrams, how many are more difficult? Can you point to the ones?
More difficult in which sense?
That they are irreducible.
Okay. I would say 400 can be done already with a 3PN version of the code, another 200.
200,
but I mean, they come maybe in 10 kinds.
Oh, 10.
No? Basically.
But it could be that some of them require integral Branchet are out of reach.
I will discuss this later.
Okay.
In a minute.
That's three, right?
Okay, so propagators are diagonal in this variable, which is good because you don't want, for example, if you use the component as VR, H00 will mix up with the trace of HIJ, and while in this way you economize in Feynman diagrams. The propagator is actually relativistic, but we can expand it for small velocities. So basically, when you see a propagator here, you should actually think it as an expansion with more and more insertions of this K squared zero, which is basically a double time derivatives, which will be discharged on the star variables. And of course, you given the order of your diagram and the order in which you want to compute the analysis, you will have to truncate this series at some point. For this diagram, which is already 4PN, you can keep only the lowest order term. But other diagrams like this one, which are 2PN, you may have to put the adequate number of propagator insertions. That's the difference between our notation and Gilmour and Ross one. They explicitly write insertions, But that multiplies the number of diagrams we have to draw. And basically, for no reason, because the strategy for solving them is the same, whether they are essential or not. And 600 is already a number. If you count that way, you get easily above 1,000. So for the propagators, you do the same. You try to define our rules for all the vertices, the bulk vertices, and for the vertices involving the Stirner sources and the gravitational degrees of freedom. Again, you have an expansion in V, and you truncate it to up to the term that you need. And you end up, the code reads this thing, he knows the final rules, and by replacement, he arrives to write this amplitude. Okay? Notice that we need, for solving the momentum integrals, to have only p in this exponential, p is the total momentum. Mm-hmm. And normally, if you write the amplitude as it is, you don't have p here. You have p2, and because these two points are different, are in principle evaluated at different times so far. In order to have a p here, you have to identify the times. And to do that, since you have a time derivative here, you have delta primes, and you have to turn it back to turn them by part. And that generates these two terms here, okay? You had the delta prime before t1 minus t4, and you have x2, x1 at t1, and x1 at t4. You have, in order to collect them and factor p, you have to turn it, to do it by part, and you generate more terms. This is important for the following, because this way you are obliged to generate more and more and more terms in your amplitudes. Indeed, we did compute the amplitudes for all the Feynman diagrams that we need to compute. And we found that some of them are pretty long for several reasons. For example, this 2PN diagram, this line just overlaps here, but there are no vertices here. It's a 2PN diagram. It is this one. Just badly drawn by my code. Since it is a 2PN diagram, you have actually all the propagators insertion to take into account. So I draw it as a single diagram, but its amplitude is as an amplitude of 16 diagrams. Mm? Moreover, since you have a lot of two propagator extensions mean four time derivatives, if you apply the same trick as before, you generate, to get a p here, you generate more and more terms. Okay? Second reason for lengthy amplitudes is that just some vertices are just long. The three sigma vertices as long as it is, it has 12 terms. And if you have many vertices, you have to multiply. If each of these vertex has three terms, this diagram end up having 27 terms, and so on. So the combination of these make that some diagrams contain several hundred terms. Not so bad for writing the amplitude, because the amplitude is written in at most a few minutes for the complicated diagrams, but to evaluate them, it slows pretty much of things. Okay. So this is just to say that the number of diagrams that is not a good tracker of the time it will take to evaluate them, because some are done in a few minutes and some are done in days, at least on my PC. Now, the evaluation. You have the amplitude. The code isolates the parts which depend on the momenta. And with some recipes, spits the result of integration truncated to the finite part in d minus 3, which is dimensional expansion parameter. And you end up with the amplitude. Remarkably, most of the amplitudes can be calculated with just with these two formulas, the Fourier transform of a p squared, p2 to 2 alpha, and then of this classical dimensional regularized integral. For example, if you have this diagram and you call the momenta like this, you have this amplitude. So the code sees that this integral is of this kind, it replaces. Now you have p1 here, no? Because this is a p1. So you will end up with an integral of a quantity having p to 2 alpha, p1 to some other power, and p to p1 to minus 2 gamma. the code sees again that there is a structure like this, does this replacement, and you end up with p to some power, and you do the last integral. Okay? Of course, here the numerator was just one. Normally, in the numerator, since there are momenta propagating here, will be more structured, and you know how to generalize. Once you have a master integral, you know how to generalize to when you have momenta up and many free indices. And we need up to 6 free indices down upstairs to evaluate all the integrals.
So you don't use Mathematica integrating that?
No.
Just replacement rules? Or?
Well, we basically built a library. And we tell Mathematica, whenever you say a structure like that, we say with the exponent, replace expression with this thing. And you do it iteratively. And then in the very end, you truncate, you expand in D minus 3. And you take only the pole and the finite part.
But the representation of that is a Mathematica fraction. It's not something
yes.
special.
No. You just use FineCalc for the contraction. Okay. The only thing we have to do is that to teach Mathematica to do this integral and the corresponding ones with non-trivial numerators. Okay. Now. If you have many iterations, like many vertices, doing this takes quite some time, and you have all the different combinations, it takes quite some time. So we do this, the result of this integral is saved, stored to some library, so that can use it for the subsequent, another Feynman diagram which will need this particular expression, okay? This allows us to save quite some time. Still, evaluation is quite lengthy. Moreover, there are some topologies. Basically, the resolution strategy for each diagram depends only on the topology. And there are also topologies in which the form is not immediately on this kind, the form of this diagram. For example, this diagram, which already appears at 2pn, has this structure, and you see any momentum, p1 and p2, appears 3 times. So you cannot apply the rule here. And you don't want the rate to be only to at the very end. But you can solve this problem by integrating by parts in momentum space. Basically, you turn this thing into the sum of the contribution in which the exponent of any of this term is lowered by 1. So you do it again and again and again until one of these terms disappear, and then you know how to do it. Okay? These strategies were already used by Gilman and Ross for their 2pn calculation. At 3pn, you just have to generalize it to various values of alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and epsilon. At 4pn, at 3pn, there are no new topologies which are tricky like that. Yeah?
No, I wonder if you had proved beforehand that at 3pn, you can get rid of all these integrals, and so that you can apply the Ries formula.
Get rid of in which sense?
You mean if you have
yes.
several source points here?
Yeah, four.
You are doing an integration by parts?
Yeah. I turn this term into the sum of these terms.
Yeah, okay. Maybe my question is after that.
Okay. Anyways, at 3pn, it turns out that only there are no new topologies with respect to 2pn, so we don't need new strategies. And the over 3pn calculation was done without telling Mathematica new information. But actually, the 4pn, there are new topologies.
This is due to the kth variables, right?
I can't hear you.
That's a feature of the Kolmogorov variables.
Yeah. 5pn, 7pn. Exactly. The old order don't get new. At 4pn, you get new nasty topologies like that, but even for that and similars, there are integration by parts that you can do to turn them into doable things. So far, I think we have done all the topologies which are tricky, except for these two, which are g to the 5 topologies. Each one generates only one graph. And so far, we couldn't find the integration by part which turns them into doable integrals, at least doable in terms of a simple formula that we have. But actually, talking with Luc Blanchet yesterday, we realized that maybe if we just evaluate these diagrams in coordinate space rather than in momentum space, it might be easier. So we will try.
I'm sorry, but there is the graviton loop there?
No, sorry, this goes behind. Okay, there is a triple vertex here, and each of two is split, one goes up and one goes down. This is non-planar diagram. It's the only non-planar diagram appearing at this point.
I wonder, the result of this problematic diagram, is it just a number, or are there also unknown powers?
Exactly, the result is just a number. So in the worst case, we can do it
just
numerically.
Just
give
it a name.
Yes, this will be a coefficient. You can read it off here. It will be a coefficient of g to the 5 m1 cube m2 cube over r to the 4 times some coefficient.
So if, it's just a coefficient in d dimension.
Yeah.
But if you have to expand around 3 dimensions.
No, because it's, this is finite.
It's finite.
Yeah, it's finite. And this as well.
So what was the other possibility?
Do it in collinear space. Since it is finite, you can work directly in d equal 3. So the propagators are easy to write. So it might work. But we just started to look at this.
That's just a number, you said?
Yeah.
There are no logs. Because it's finite, there are no logs.
Uh-huh. Because
so it's just a 1 over
half
clock,
1
over
half.
Yes, in the worst case, we will do it numerically. It is g to the 5, so it cannot have a velocity correction. It must be a number. So this is the point now. We are a few dozen diagrams away from the 4PL. The code is running right now to do the remaining ones. And while the code runs, we are thinking how to deal with two remaining diagrams. And we hope to get that done soon. So I will not discuss conclusions because I prefer to let Ricardo explain this part of the talk, and then we will conclude, because this is just one, the whole project, it's better to conclude it.
You call these variables momentum.
Yeah.
Why is it momentum?
They are momentum. They are Fourier transform like of a...
It looks more like wave numbers, because it multiplies.
Okay, if you wish, they are the wave numbers, yes.
H bar is one.
Sorry for using this quantum terminology over time, but I just use it. So I think now we'll let Ricardo come here and continue, unless you want to ask question first or.
Yeah. Sorry, can you go back one slide?
Of course.
So can you demote a little the level of discussion to the level of non-experts? So what was the discussion about that thing being a number versus involving funny powers of what?
Hello, this is a 4PN diagram.
Yes.
Okay. It has a power g to the 5.
Yes.
I can read it off a topology. Okay. And it contains 3 terms of mass 1 and 3 terms of mass 2. Okay. Since it is g to the 5 and since it is a 4PN, you don't get velocity corrections. Because otherwise you go to 5PN. G to the 5 is already 4PN. So the diagram will be g to the 5, m1 cube, n2 cube over r, help me to the
6,
times some number. What else can it be?
OK, what is the other possibility? The unwake possibility would be
r to the 5.
The 5? OK.
If it's just a number, then you can just do numerical.
Exactly. We started looking at it before coming here. If we can get it analytically, we'll do. Otherwise, do it numerically.
Yeah.
No problem. But you know, numerically, you don't get pi's. If we can do it analytically, we go for it. But we're not going to lose one time of our to do that. We'll do numerically otherwise. Okay.
How accurately can you give such a high-dimensional integral numerically?
Monte Carlo?
You told that it's not
incredible.
It's finite.
It's finite, this one.
So just not equal to 4, 3.
No, because it's finite once you regularize it dimensionally. That doesn't have pole in the dimensional regularization. But we will get rid of that. That was.
So I have actually.
It was first, sorry.
Can I ask again this question about this integral?
Which one?
This one.
This one, yeah.
I if I integrate over P2,
yes,
then I get some integral, this 3P2, something like that, divided by, so there are three factors, so there are three points, which are P1, P, and 0, because there is a P2 which is alone.
No, you don't do it like that.
Okay, but the...
I want to apply this formula. Yeah.
And so you cannot, because there are three points.
Okay.
So what you do is that you integrate by part in Fourier domain. And
exactly.
You can show that up to 3p and order, all terms will be computable with the RIS formula.
Yes.
With only two points.
Yes.
But now, at 4p and order, you expect that there will be plenty of integrals which have three or more points.
Yes.
That you cannot use the RIS formula.
But you can always find an integration by part, maybe in two successive stages. For example, this one, you can do it by part.
For particular diagrams, maybe. But can
always.
You prove that for all diagrams at 4p and order, you can do this? Possibly.
I cannot prove it, but we actually did it. All the topologies we could
so
solve.
That's the crucial point for 4p.
But they can try to do it.
We did it.
You can try, but...
They did it, but
we did it.
It's a point. It's better than
at 3pn, we can have arguments from the beginning that which shows that you can do the calculation because you can deploy for each of the terms the RIS formula.
Okay. We didn't know a priori we could do them, but it turned out we can.
Yeah, apart from the last two.
Apart from the last two. But this one, for example, we can do it. We will turn it into something similar to this, and then again. You will really ask a question?
Andy. Because you cannot.
You can. So you said diagrams like these ones are the hardest ones.
Yeah.
So are there order of 10 or so of these, or how many?
Sorry?
How many of these diagrams are actually
two.
There?
Because the G to the 5 topology are very constrained because you don't want these V corrections, so each one of these legs must be a 5. Okay.
I know, but there are of the order 20 something diagrams I can write down. Some of them factorize or are trivially nested integrals, right?
No, no, no. There are 50 topologies G to the 5. Each topology generates one single diagram which is relevant at 4pn. And we can do all of them except for these two so far.
Okay, so the ones you can do, you're using integration by parts relations?
We can't do immediately. Visually, we do it by part, and we discover we can do them. And these two, we didn't find so far a by part integration, which turns them into doable diagrams.
So those diagrams are power divergent?
Yes.
You said
you
can't.
Yes.
So how
but they are not of a linear divergence. So in dimensional regularization, you will get only finite.
Sure. But how are you going to do it numerically then?
Yeah. Well, there is you can apply the prescription of
you
dimensional regularization.
You have to do it as a
function of
D. Yeah. Yeah. No.
Analytically continuum.
Yeah. I don't think so. Since it is finite, you can do it in D equals.
There is no external moment. You have to take derivatives. Taking derivatives with respect to x isn't going to help.
Well, I don't know.
You can subtract anything.
I think we will end up doing this in coordinate space, in D equal 3.
You can do power into last.
Well,
if you do numerically, you don't care.
If you come up with a way of doing this, just send us an email.
It's going to get quadratic divergences, and that's going to swamp the value of the integral.
Okay, suggestions welcome. Send us an email, and we'll be very happy. So. Other questions?
So quantum field theory does something as hard as that?
Yeah.
What the?
And do people just have an integration by parts?
There are Russians
Germans.
Who are brought up from kindergarten to do these things. They're
just
trained.
Call,
yeah, but they're not very forthcoming with their secrets. But they'll like public
but
results, but they won't tell you any of your media stuff.
No, really?
But also,
I thought from my view that they all working for dimensions.
But they do some things in D dimensions, too.
Yeah. At the really high order, they don't.
Yeah. When they get to four loops.
The talk is all called over. They can't resist to tell you.
There's a guy named Smirnov.
Yeah.
And Smirnov is known to go to, there have been cases where he'll show up at a conference and say, I have the following integral, does anybody need it?
Okay, I write an email.
That's actually true.
Okay, true story. The cattle.
So, I mean, I would, if you contacted Smirnov, I would not be surprised if he had it somewhere.
Or knew how to do it.
He may ask you have to put his name Money. On the paper, but that's between you and him.
Can you check?
Smirnov doesn't make mistakes. What's that?
Yeah,
there are two of them. His son also does integrals. They both
do. He really
wants
to know how to KGB.
No, his son is a mathematician who also
does
the
guy.
Oh, I don't know.
That's a different guy.
So, I won't be long also because there are 10 slides left, basically 9.5, tell about something that somebody else has already been presented. So it will be just an overview and the result of the day term, which gives contribution to the conservative dynamics at 4 p.m. has already been computed some 13 years ago. So we just demonstrated that the Fatigue Theory method can recover. Of course, we have no doubt of it, but it's just nice to see how it works. So, what is the term we're talking about? As you know, there is the work term gravitational reaction, which gives the order affect the dynamics of the binary dynamics at 2.5. This, of course, gets all correction from PN modified dynamics of the multiple, but the term we are interested in is 1.5 with respect to the leading work term gravitational reaction potential. And this is Tay term, which has been computed back in 88 by Blanchet d'Amour. And it admits, the important thing is that it admits a conservative part. This is clearly non-conservative as it is, because as you see, there's no invariance under T goes to minus T. But one can extract, and actually it was done in this paper by Duke and collaborators, it can extract a conservative part that affects the conservative equation of motion in this way. And where this is the proper cutoff.
Ricardo, you are at 4 p.m. Which order are you?
Yeah, this is affects the conservative dynamics at 4 p.m. That's why we wanted to include in the rest of the 4 p.m.
Sorry, what is lambda?
Okay, lambda is a suitable cutoff. I will tell you later.
Okay.
Yes, I will come to it.
And is this conservative part totally ambiguous?
That's unambiguous.
Yes, okay. Maybe. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
It is unambiguous if you assume the existence of a helical killing vector, as I was saying this morning. And so this lambda is simply associated with the helical killing vectors. And so we must include that term.
That seems like a very strong assumption. There's such a symmetry.
This is the way to say that the dynamics is conservative. Exactly,
circular. Yeah, I will come to this point at the end anyway. So this was the result of the standard paper. What is the physics embodied in this result? Well, the physics is a gravitational disk is emitted, scattered by the Newtonian potential, and then reabsorbed by the system. So I have no net flux because I have emission and reabsorption, but I have the modification of the dynamics of the system. So it was computed back in the old days, and we decided, okay, since we want to recover, we want to find the 4PN, let's see that we are able to recover these two. And things went pretty straightforward indeed. Okay, this is one of the 9 slides that repeat things you already heard. So I'll be quite quick. You know, we have to separate scales. We start with a scale in which we have all the fundamental degrees of freedom, then we consider point like sources. We recover the dynamics at 3PN with all the divergences that were known in the standard approach. And then, all in all, we find a theory in which I have some point particle, which is fundamental, but it has a lot of hair. It's all but a black hole. It has all the multiple, and all this multiple couples to gravitational waves. And the dynamics of the multiple, of course, is given by the matching, as we've been discussing earlier. And they interact with gravity waves, and they also interact with these constrained gravitational modes
that were mentioned earlier. I mean, whenever you have gravity, you have both gravity waves and constrained modes. The constrained modes satisfy Poisson equations, so they don't propagate infinity. They are sourced by the matter. And then there is the gravitational waves, which satisfies box equation, so they can propagate freely to infinity. Anyway, I mean, one would expect that this interaction of the quadrupole gives rise only to dissipative effect. This is not true, because since we know since 88, there is also this conservative effect given by this dissipative physics. How do you compute it in effective theory methods? Well, it's simply a generalization of this. I mean, Chad told us yesterday very nicely about how to compute this kind of effect. This kind of effect renormalizes the real part of the action. So renormalizing the real part of the action is the same thing as saying, look, I'm modifying the dynamics of the system. So the effective action is modified in the real part in one way, and this leading term is just the Burke-Thorne potential, which has been recomputed in the effective theory formal in this paper. And of course, there is an imaginary part. And of course, I'm not telling you about this imaginary part because the previous talk was all about this. Let me just stress that what they did was to use the optical theorem, so they only computed the imaginary part. But so we focus on the real part, not the leading order, which is the Burke-Thorne potential, but the first genuine nonlinear order. Okay, this is a slide about the in-in formalism. Okay, it was such a nice talk yesterday that I don't really need to go through this, which actually doesn't present quite as clearly as it was done yesterday. We just have to remember that in order to do this computation for the real part of the action, we have to double the degrees of freedom and then go back. We have to let propagate 1 degree of freedom from minus infinity to plus infinity, and then the second degrees of freedom back from plus infinity to now. And then this doubling of degrees of freedom tell us what is the prescription for the sources, for the external sources. How do they connect through Green functions? I have a specific prescription that the sources in the Kalish representation connect through advanced and retarded propagator. This source you can forget because, as we all know now, for the equation of motion, only the mix plus minus term are important to determine the equation of motion, so only these off-diagonal terms. So basically, from the effective action, we have to derive with respect to the x minus variable, and then set the x minus variable equal to zero, the x plus variable equal to the physical variables, and then we get the equation of motion. I mean, this is the result that we got from the in-in formalism applying to gravitational system. I mean, okay, then let's do it. So what do we do? We take this composite system, and we insert a quadrupole which emits a graviton. Then this graviton interacts with the Newtonian potential, which of course is sourced by the leading multiple, which is the monopole, and then it gets here solved. And this diagram if we parameterize the gravitational field in the usual Coles-Mölkin variable, then it gets split into six. And actually, only, you see, I have sigma a, sigma phi, a, all the six combination of the sigma I, a phi field. And actually it happens that only the sigma, a, and phi phi field contribute. These three, one, two, three, this mix are zero, please.
Why did you use the phi sigma variables here, not the h variables?
Yeah, because we had all the vertices in this variable, so it carried over. I mean, here we get six diagrams instead of one, but we get much simpler vertices. So the trade-off is pretty much the same. Of course, if you had obtained 100 diagrams, that would probably reduce the other. So this is just to give you a sketch of how this effective action, of course I'm computing the real part in this informalism, looks like. You see I have twice the quadrupole. Each quadrupole is acted upon with two derivatives because that's the usual coupling of the quadrupole to the metric. And then look at this. I have this vertex always carries two derivatives, so here I get two derivatives. And then I get a green function from this propagator, a green retarded function from this propagator, the wavy one, and then I get this green function is just the instantaneous green function, so I can just substitute it with one over r. And basically, this tells you in that the all the gravity, I mean, this multiples, this object which has multiple source, all the gravitons, not only the gravity waves, but also the other gravitons which we satisfy Poisson equation, not box equation, the constrained gravitons. And that is here. That is just the one over our green function.
In principle, we should, to be consistent, we should be in d dimensions here.
Yes, but okay, we could do that, but okay, there is one practical thing. The computation is far simpler. I mean, just for presentation in the direct space. And what we are unable to compute doing in three dimensions is just the finite part beside the that affects the. Beside the 1 over epsilon, say. Here we don't get 1 over epsilon, we get just an infinity that we regularize by cutoff, say. And of course, by keep working in three dimensions, then we cannot get the exact value of this finite part. We got some technical troubles in doing the computation in the Fourier space, which would allow to use propagators in the dimension, and then we would get also that exact
finite
part.
But you could use X-space propagators in three dimensions, right?
We can't. Can we?
Of course you can. So it's not 1 over r, but 1 over r to the
No, not for the retarded. For the instantaneous, yes, not for the retarded, there's no simple generalization like that. No.
Is that true?
Well, there's no closed form. It's an integral over a vector function times time times square root.
Yeah. Yeah. Only for the instantaneous you can generalize. Did I answer your question?
Sorry?
No. I mean, only for the instantaneous you can generalize.
I'm surprised it's so complicated.
No, only basically, you have a closed form, closed simple form, only for integer dimensions. For generic dimensions, you don't have a simple closed form, but for the instantaneous potential. This is just because, I mean, this retarded propagator is a, I didn't write it down, is a, the instantaneous propagator is a delta. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I was answering your question. This retarded propagator is something like that, and it's not trivial to generalize to arbitrary non-integer dimension.
I see.
Okay. Okay, this is just technical.
It doesn't propagate in the light cone either, right? In higher dimensions or
okay.
That's one of the problems.
Okay. I didn't know that one. Okay, very good. So this is just to give you a sketch of how the computation looks like. It really fits a page if you look at the paper. I mean, it's not a very complicated computation. Please.
Sorry, just go back to the retarded propagator from in put in Fourier space and you just change the I epsilon description and then
yes, and it works.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. You just add the addition of the six terms and you take the proper contraction and you add them all. And what do you again, surprise, surprise, and you get the same result as the old paper by Blanchet de Moore. And what do you get? You get here, I mean, we split the result in these two parts because here it shows the short distance singularity explicitly. This is the logarithmic singularity explicitly, which we simply throw away. And this is the physical term that appears and exactly match the results obtained by standard methods. But here we have to include a scale, of course, once we have a logarithm that we have to include the arbitrary renormalization scale. In the language of effective theory, we know what is the meaning of this scale. Is the scale that basically tells at this scale we have to use the renormalized quadrupole moments. So the bare quadrupole moments that do not depend on this arbitrary scale, just because there is a compensation between the renormalization factor and the renormalized. So once I express the okay, but this is still the result that is not conservative. It contains both physics from the dissipative and conservative effect.
Could
in order
write
to
down the mu dependence of z.
Yeah.
Can you write that down?
Yeah, it's the next slide. Okay, but then we do this trick that we borrow from the recent paper by Luke et al. And what do? You just do this trivial algebra and you calculate at the renormalization scale mu fixed to be 1 over r. At this point, you plug this back in here and you, the part which doesn't give a conservative, you just put it aside. And this term here gives the conservative contribution to the potential. And you obtain the equation of motion exactly in the same way. And this lambda for us, just because in this cutoff regularization we have the ambiguity in the finite part, of course, this lambda for us is arbitrary.
So how do you see that as a UV divergence here?
It's a short distance.
No, I understand, right? That's what I but how do you see it from the integrals or?
Well, it's a, the physically you see the divergence when basically the two quadrupole insertion happens to be at the same time. That's what we call a short distance. Oh yeah, that's
yeah. I mean.
Okay. And then this is very nicely done in direct space. You can translate it in coordinate space, where you can make also a match between the real part and the imaginary part of the action. So you see, this is the imaginary part that has been computed and has been presented before. You see, you have the quadrupole and the quadrupole of minus k, so this is real, and this is imaginary, so this is actually imaginary. And then you have all the correction, 1.5, 3, and the logarithm at the 3pn. Here is the real part. You see, this is not real, this is complex, because I have q minus q plus. And this is imaginary, so it means that this, once it multiplies this, it fits the imaginary part of this. But this is fine, because the real part of this is even under k goes to minus k. So if I hit with this, the real part of this, integrate it from minus infinity to infinity gives zero, which, of course, it's correct, because I want the real part from this side. And then again, the 1pn correction, the 1.5pn correction to this, which is just the result I showed before, integrated over the past, which is recasted into the k-space. So, of course, the two parts, effective and real, they have the same dependence on q, the same power of k's. But, I mean, the coefficients are different, and they describe different physics.
So your UV logs never show up in imaginary parts, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And
yes, you can say it a posteriori just because we did the computation separately and we don't find any match.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is, if you were to resum your logs and or predict, you know, log squares at higher order, right?
Mm-hmm.
They better not show up in the imaginary part.
Yeah, absolutely, because they wouldn't match.
Because they wouldn't match with free.
Exactly.
Results.
Exactly.
So somehow that has to be true.
But it's
order.
The same coupling constant, right? So.
Yes, the coupling constant is the same, yes.
Okay, oh, we
this Q is only time dependent, so this K is really a number, it's not a vector. Right? This K is
well,
really
it's a complex number, right? So maybe its anomalous dimension is complex. I don't know. I mean,
so, you see, this is real, then when it hits this, it picks the real part of this, which is fine, because
this is
even under K goes to minus K, and
yeah,
even for K goes to minus K.
Then I have another question. So in our case, when we find the UV divergence, we claim that if we did it in the full theory, taking the one world line and actually splitting up into two world lines, we claim that in the full theory, it's fine. Right?
Okay.
So you could do your calculation
that's
on the full theory.
And check that it's finite just because of the separation.
Would you expect it to be finite, or if not, what would be renormalized?
Yes, I would say so because, okay, we haven't done that, but now that you suggest, I'm curious to see. Because you see, this is related to the time of the emission and absorption. If I split the two parts, the emission and the absorption, the two times cannot be the same. So I expect that the divergence would go away if I split. Okay, we can do it.
What are the
divergence?
Okay, look first and then.
I don't understand why you don't obtain directly that your constant mu is 1 over the radius, the distance to the two. Because I think that the term you obtain directly as an integral of the log divided by r, the distance to the two. There is no arbitrary constant.
Yeah, I know that in your paper you use this. I think that in the effective theory, okay, maybe other people in the audience might have different opinions, but. In this formula, this is really the renormalization scale, and it is arbitrary. It is arbitrary in the sense that it tells me that the quadrupole is renormalized by this UV effect. And once it is renormalized, I know its dependence on the log. I mean, this is the standard way of considering divergences that give logarithms of an arbitrary scale. In this case, if you like, I can immediately say that mu is 1 over r because r is the preferred scale at which I know my quadrupole. I mean, at which is the scale I know the quadrupole at the distance separation.
Yeah, but in principle, this is a term which appears in the equations in the metric voice.
Yes.
Now, if you compute the equations of motion from that term, if you obtain that it is not mu but whatever r, you will take the gradient of that and it will give you a contribution.
No,
but
okay.
If you obtain that mu,
you
is a constant.
You don't have to derive. You don't have to derive. This is a scale. This is the renormalization scale. This is not the physical distance of the two objects. You don't have to derive when you take the equation of motion. This is an external source. For the equation of motion, I have this Q is an external source. You don't derive the source, this external source. You derive the X.
Yeah, but me, I will do it. Because if I guess that this is one of the...
You don't do that either in your paper. You don't do it either.
No, but I will do it for the equation of motion with... You will have to differentiate this whatever r which is inside the domain.
No, but you consider
it as a constant.
We don't do this approach because this is just the renormalization scale, but you don't do it either in your paper. You don't differentiate the r that you put in there.
But because we don't look at the equations of motion
and form. Oh, yeah, you do. I mean, this equation is.
We compute only the metric.
No. In the 2010 paper, you also put the equation of motion. That's where I checked.
Ah, yes, but.
We don't compute the metric. So, in order to perform the check, we have to check the equation of motion.
Yes, but we did that. That's the reason because in the form example, mu is one of the r. There is no choice.
Yes, but you don't derive the r in the logarithm. You don't.
Yes. This is the original formula. The metric is this term is mu is equal to 1 over r.
Yes, but then when you obtain the equation of motion, you just obtain this. You don't derive the log.
Yeah, but this is because of that trick, because the lambda is
out. Yeah, but I think we are saying the same things, but I mean, this is just a trick. Lambda is completely arbitrary because this is an identity, whatever lambda. Okay, this is a dummy ray scale, but I mean, it's the scale at which I consider the renormalization of the quadruple. I mean, if I put whatever mu I put in here, I know that I have to put the same mu for the quadruple. This is the standard renormalization procedure when I get logarithm is running. So it's physically in the sense. Once I fix it, I know that the quadruple I use in my formula is the quadruple at that scale. So this scale tells me that the quadruple is computed at that scale. But this is not something I have to derive over.
Sorry. Can I question? First, obviously, this is an amazing job that both of you did, and it's wonderful to hear about the progress, and I think we're all looking forward to your final results. And the issue that I want to highlight is the use of the Feynman propagator and imaginary action. Of course, this is standard in quantum physics. However, I'm not aware that in classical physics, anybody uses either of these concepts. And it would be very interesting to see whether these are, in the classical limit, these are essential. Okay, so maybe somebody else wants to answer it. These are essential, or you can say it in a different way. Or if it is essential, then it would be interesting to see how it works.
My point of view on the topic is Feynman diagrams tells you a way to iteratively solve equations. If the coefficient of expansion is h bar, or is v, the velocity, like in PN physics, it doesn't matter. The Green function formula is in the, it works all the way throughout.
The propagator.
Throughout.
The propagator. In classical physics, it's the target.
In all the 500 identified diagrams, the modes are off-shell. So the propagator is just.
Asking about the effective action that Ricardo showed.
Yeah.
What about
this is the real part. Sorry. So maybe I didn't get the question. Sorry.
Two questions. One, you're using the Feynman propagator, which is not quite the retarded.
No, we're not using the
Feynman propagator on one of the transparencies. Maybe they don't.
No, it was not the Feynman
propagator.
No,
if you go a few transparencies back, I'll show you the Feynman.
No, okay.
It says there, you see?
Yeah, but I mean, this is the 1-2 basis. If I go to the Kalischer presentation, which is the one of.
So you don't use it.
No, it boils down to use the advance and retard.
Okay, great. So we crossed off one item. The second item, you have an imaginary part of the action.
I don't, because I compute only the real part.
So Stefano has?
No.
We only compute the real part. I mean, this is just.
There are no imaginary parts to the action.
Okay, no. This is what I show here is the one found in the paper by Walter and Andreas.
Yes.
And I just copied it just for the sake of comparison. But this is not what we compute.
But is anybody using an imaginary part of an action?
Not yet.
Not we didn't, but we should. We learned it.
Okay, so it's a question to you.
What's the problem?
The question is, in quantum physics, this is standard.
Yeah.
In classical physics, I don't know of any use of this.
Yes,
in
so
previous
do.
What's just the previous talk?
So, in the plus minus spaces, so
can we go back
about
to
yesterday? In the plus minus spaces, I was only considering classical things that only have classical propagators, so that GH there never appeared.
Yeah,
the GH
you can put a zero.
The imaginary part of the finite field.
Yes.
And if you include that, what's interesting is that, and compute the effect of action and so on, what you can show is that the imaginary part of that affected in action. It is proportional to this GH, and the GH, in turn, if you take the number of derivatives and substitute two points equal to each other, gives you the stress tensor. So you can compute the powers from the effective action in something like that.
So I didn't understand all the details, but you're telling me that it is an essentially classical concept, an imaginary
GH
part of the action.
GH is technically a part of the quantum two-point function.
Well, but not necessarily.
Well, you're right. The imaginary part computes a decay rate for a graviton.
If there was never quantum
emission
physics,
rate,
would we use this concept?
Well, you would. This is as you know. This has come up before many times. It's just a mathematical way of simplifying the calculation. In the end, you end up with a completely classical.
Right.
You can do it other ways if you want.
It's an intermediate
but
step.
But it's just an intermediate step that helps them cut down the amount of work
yeah.
they get.
But it is. So it is an essential intermediate step? That's my question. Is
it
an
essential?
It's
not an essential.
No,
there are other ways
you
can do it. You can organize the calculation differently if you wanted to. It's just if we have this technique that makes it easier, why not use it?
Yeah, so the question is it a natural thing? It's I don't know how to define it well, how to make a good definition of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, some things you introduce and there you multiply by two and you divide by two and there's nothing interesting in that.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's a new tool that you introduce and it's really essential to the computation.
Well, I mean, so if you look at chapter 13 of Jackson, he does Compton scattering classically, and then he does it from the equivalent of a Feynman diagram. You can show you get the same answer. So I mean,
he calls it the method of virtual quantum.
Yeah, but you get
in classical.
In classical.
Yeah, it's in Jackson. Yeah. So it's just.
But isn't it like describing classical, I don't know, electromagnetic wave with complex phases?
No, I don't think so. It's the action. It's the action again. It's not the. It's not enough.
But the action is the iconic, right? You know, the IS. That's a classical wave amplitude.
Yeah, but it has to be much
into the IS. There is no E to the IS.
Well, I mean, so.
I think you can use Feynman boundary conditions classically, and then the action can have an imaginary part that corresponds to the optical theorem classically that
but
you can do with Maxwell equations.
Such boundary conditions?
Because you're smart and you realize that you can use it and simplify your computation. You can do it classically.
No, usually. You have boundary conditions that are not cap waves coming from
the best. This is okay. With the hand side of quantum mechanics, you can use Feynman boundary conditions, but you can do everything classical.
So I think it requires some rationale.
Now look, maybe there is one.
Can I ask you something about your result?
Okay, so please.
So when you write the C that Andy was asking you, what is your C? Do you write it down? I haven't seen it yet.
Since we don't go to the dimension different than 3, we just cannot compute the exact value of C. But
the C that they computed is fixed, it's given. So why doesn't work for your case? You don't get the same range.
No, just because we didn't go to dimensional regularization, we did a cutoff. Just because of that.
No, but at this order they don't get any C, right? And you're getting a C.
Of course they get a C. Yes, which is a number, of course, which is written in their paper.
At this order they don't get any C. Right?
Yeah, I just didn't bother to copy it, but they do get a number, of course.
But it comes a higher order, not in this tail.
Yeah, yes. I mean.
No, the C, not that C.
Yeah, no, he meant the renormalization.
No, the
C,
normalization.
C.
Ah, sorry. Ah, right, right. Oh, right, sorry. Sorry, I call it that. No, of course, okay, this is the point, this is the point. Here we are computing something different. This is not...
But you have one operator to renormalize, right? How do you explain that, that you get a different answer?
Okay, this, I wish we can come out of an answer out of this discussion. Okay, my point of view is that, you see...
I think it's working.
Yeah. This is... I mean, we are completely something different.
No. Q is renormalized. I don't care how you compute it. It's one operator. It has one renormalization. It's done. Right.
Okay. There is one renormalization that contributes to its dynamics, and there's
no,
one renormalization.
Two different. You cannot have two different ones, right? Once you have a coupling, it enters everywhere, right?
Wait, but depends. What is the question you're asking? Here we're asking, how is the dynamics of Q modified? Here you're asking, what is the rate of decay of Q? I think that's the key.
Yeah, but at the order that you work at, there gets no renormalization whatsoever. So C is, starts at zero at this order, right?
Yes, I know.
What?
A set or whatever.
At certain point.
Yes,
but
I know.
Which order starts? That's right. How does the running of Q, at which order starts? That's the question. Yeah.
Okay. The answer I have is the one I've given. I mean, if you answer what is the normalization due to conservative effect, you get one. If you ask the normalization due to the conservative effect, and or if you probe your problem with an external graviton of momenta Q, you get a different answer because you're using different probes to your system. Okay, I see you're not satisfied.
I think what Raphael's trying to say is that there's one Q. You have an action, and you can't, you know, it's not fair to say you use the action, like this action for this or that action for that. You have a unique action, and you have to, it has to be applicable in every problem.
Can't we say that the Z is the sum of the two, but you see only one part if you compute something?
That could be. In principle, that's true. That could be a possibility, but I don't know if that's true. But you have to. What we're trying to understand is if that's true. Yeah, we're also impossible. I mean, about this. But I mean, the fact of the 4PN conservative part is there. I mean, we cannot doubt about this. That is there. Now it comes, what is the interpretation of the renormalization?
Why did you work with the intelligence?
Just because we use the direct space representation, so we use the exact D equal to 3 propagators.
You couldn't do the integral in D dimensions? Is that
basically, yes, we had to move to the Fourier space. The computation is a little bit more involved, and we couldn't get the results before the conference.
Oh, I see.
But you understand the scaling is different, right? So
yeah,
no,
I understand.
I'm saying that if that log does not enter in their imaginary part at the order that you claim there is a log.
No, look, of course, this is a 1.5 with respect to the leading,
exactly.
And this is a 3 with respect to the leading.
Exactly.
Of course, it's very different. Actually, this is also the relative imaginary with respect to that. And actually, in the computation of the optical theorem, they also find a term which is relatively imaginary at 1.5. But that, of course, is discarded because you have to take the modulus square. And that's not ultraviolet. It's, I mean, it's completely different.
Totally
different. I agree. So, OK.
But this is true. No, go ahead.
No, I mean, I understand. This is the main point. I mean, if we understand that the 4PN conservative term comes out of the divergent and gives a logarithm term, then we have to accept that somehow it leads to the regularization of the quadrupoid. What is the exact meaning of that? Yeah, I tend to say that one regularization appears in the conservative side, the other in the dissipative side. I can understand that it might not be fully satisfactory explanation.
So how do you do the matching onto the theory? You have to match to get the value of the renormalized coefficient, right?
Well, they compare with Lanchilis, right?
No. Okay. We just assume the Q. I mean, our fundamental field is our fundamental particle is the quadrupole. I mean, the particle with all the multiples. So we take Q as a black box as our fundamental. So we get the prefactor, and we get the prefactor right. This prefactor of the log. That's the correct one.
But if you want to get this, if you want, I mean, to get, you need to know the numerical coefficient, right, of the other.
No, it's come out of the amplitude computation. The numerical coefficient in front of here is this one. And there's no ambiguity about that. It's computed. We just compute from the amplitude. I mean, the amplitude is really not difficult to compute. I mean, you can.
No, I believe that the result is right. Also, look at the right
yes.
result. I'm not saying there's something
wrong. I understand, I understand.
There's something to understand.
Exactly, I agree with that. We have to understand that in terms of renormalization of the quadrupole. I understand that. I mean, I agree with you. I agree that this explanation is not fully satisfactory, and yes, we should discuss it. But apart from that, I mean, this result is there. Yeah, maybe we can discuss together, Raphael.
Yes.
So
yes.
We can discuss together, right?
We can discuss after.
No, I mean,
what you're doing now.
Yes.
Oh, so we need to stop and discuss?
Either discuss together or we discuss later, but why you keeping the things for the three of you?
We like
yeah,
each other.
So let us start the speaker.
Ah, wait, yeah, the conclusion. Sorry, so the conclusion is we wrap everything. For the 4PN, for the standard conservative part, we have 500 over about 600 diagram results. The code is running right while I'm speaking. And
so you compute already those 500 graphs?
Yes.
Oh.
And then there are a few graphs which are not obvious and they might require some tricks. The data has been reproduced. We still have to interpret it, but it has been reproduced nicely. And so what we'll be doing, the manipulation to attack the last diagrams, and also to, you know, the Lagrangian has to be massaged a little bit to get rid of accelerations, to move to the center of mass frame in order to get the Lagrangian in a nice frame. Then there will be a few consistency checks. Of course, we cannot check with the previous result, though there will be a few consistency checks to perform, like the poles can be nicely cancelled, that there will be independence on the subtraction scale for the divergences, that Lorentz invariance. And then, of course, there will be several limits in which we will be able to check the result. So we hope that in a few months we'll be there, and then we can discuss.
Thank you.